Hi, I'm obviously Donna. And I'm going first because if I went last, I would have to correct everything he said. So I'm going to go first. Although it's tempting to have the last word. I did want that. But I'm really honored to be here tonight. I'm humbled to be here, and I'm very grateful that I'm still here. I'm still in these rooms. And it has been a very long journey, a difficult journey. And I'm really grateful to all the people in this room that keep coming back. I know a lot of familiar faces. This is my third convention. I went to the convention in Atlanta. We were about a year and a half, maybe 2 years into sobriety, and I listened to a speaker, and she was awesome and showed this great story and how she and her husband were both working the program, and it was great. And 7 years into the program, he walked in the door one day and said, "I'm leaving." And I was devastated. I said, "Wait a minute, I don't want to sign up for that program. I want to be in the one where your marriage makes it. If you do everything right, then your marriage makes it." And that's the way I've always kind of done life. If I do everything right, then things are going to turn out the way that I want them to turn out. And I know that there are no guarantees now, and I know that. And I'm just grateful that so far and for today, my marriage has made it. So I'm going to try to talk about what happened briefly, because you guys have all lived what has happened. Most of you have. It's fitting that I speak here because this story starts about an hour and a half away from here. This is where I grew up, in Nashville, or right outside of Nashville. My mother was a very angry woman, a very fearful woman. She grew up in a lot of poverty. There was just a lot of fear surrounding her family. She was very prone to rage. She was very isolated, didn't have a lot of friends, and she was very busy. And my mother's response to everything was, "Don't feel, get busy." Okay, and that's been very functional for me. She was also very much a helper, a rescuer, and she did not perceive boundaries at all. I mean, where she did not understand where she stopped and other people started. Not even close. And so I learned that well from her. But my mother, I was also my mother's favorite. I was her special baby girl. And it took me a long time to figure out how that had harmed me. Because it took me a long time to get angry with her, to see where the problem was, because I liked being special baby girl, and I liked the attention, and I liked being loved in a special way, and that really set me up for a lifetime of being an Essanon. My father was very distant, absent most of the time, working a lot. He was very quiet. I got no affection from my father. I always thought maybe that was because of him, but now sometimes I think it's because my mother wouldn't let him. I'm not sure, but my mother definitely was the overpowering force in our family, and she ruled roost. And I got the message from my father that I wasn't very important because I was ignored a lot. And my sister was very angry because she was not special baby girl. For other reasons too, I'm sure. I had a lot of food issues, and that was our family. I was the baby, 5 years younger than my sister. And our family, I would say, was really aloof. I mean, we were kind of enmeshed in our relationships, but we also were not very connected. Does that make sense? I mean, we all kind of did our own thing. We lived together, and there was no forgiveness in my household. My mother's philosophy was, if you were family, you just took it. You just took it on the chin. And so if there was a hurt or a problem, we just glossed it over and just kept right on going, because that's what family did. You know, we did not have open arguments, although she and my father argued a lot. There were no feelings allowed in our household except for happy and her anger. And I spent most of my time trying to keep her happy. A lot of my time, even a lot of my adult years, trying to keep her happy. And one of the other rules in our family is we were helpers and we did not need help. We were very self-righteous, very religious, and we helped other people, and we never had problems. If we did, no one saw them, and we would never need help from anybody else. And the shame in our family was just overwhelming. Overwhelming. Could not ask for anything. I grew up really lonely. My sister was older. I was by myself a lot. I became a really high achiever. Besides keeping my mom happy, I became kind of hyper-religious too, and I was trying to keep God happy all the time too. So I was really busy trying to keep God and my mom happy and trying to be really good. I received no sexual information in my family growing up. And somehow I got the sense from being around them that sex was bad, and a kind of a sense from my mother that men needed it and women shouldn't. And that was it. That's all I got. And I got from her and from the church that I grew up in to be afraid, to be really afraid, and be afraid of anything that was different. My mother was raised in a very small, almost cultish-like church, and my dad was in the military, so that led to our isolation. But when we moved back home, we were involved in this church, and some of the chief rules were: don't listen to anybody outside of your religion, don't talk to anybody outside of your religion, and whatever you do, don't change. You know, that, to me, that's almost the antithesis of recovery. But that's what I was raised in. That was the religion I was raised in. My world was pretty uneventful, I would say, or I had all that stuff going on, but relatively uneventful until I was 11 years old. My mother had always kept me very, very close to home, and she decided that I was old enough to go 30 minutes up the road and spend the week with my grandparents in the summertime. And I had cousins up there, and I looked forward to it, even though I never really spent the night away from home. And on my very first day away from home, I was sexually abused by my maternal grandfather. And today, even though it was a horrible thing that scarred my life, I can look back on it with gratitude, because at 11 years old, I knew there was something dreadfully wrong with my family. And I kept the secret for years and years and years. And I remember that night being tortured, laying in the bed, wondering if he would try to come into the bedroom where I was sleeping, and praying, you know, just to be able to be quiet, to be able to keep it a secret. The shame was just overwhelming. And I did a good job at keeping it a secret for a long time. And then I reached, of course, I was adolescent then, or pre-adolescent. I spent a lot of time escaped into fantasy and my loneliness. I spent a lot of time rearranging my closet and my drawers and things like that. In high school, I had a lot of inappropriate stuff going on, some professors, people where I worked. You know, it was like, what is it? You know, am I like a magnet for this stuff? I did have a boyfriend later on, and I finally kind of broke up with him because all he ever wanted to do was make out. And I was like, this is not fun. After 2 years of that, I thought that's all he wanted to do. So I went off to college, and I met Mr. Perfect, and my mother thought he was perfect, so he must have been perfect. And after a long-distance relationship for about a year, he called and broke up with me one day. And I was a sophomore. No, I guess I was a junior by then, junior in college, and I was devastated. And I always knew I wasn't good enough for this man, and I was angry, and I was hurt, and I was very lonely, and I decided that good girls have no fun, and I decided that I would start having more fun. So I started drinking a lot, and waking up in places that I should not have been, and luckily I lived, and nothing terrible happened to me. And part of this, I tell this part of the story because at that crossroads, I don't really know which program I should have been in. At that time, I probably could have qualified for both, but It got too scary, I guess. I met my first real significant relationship with an SA. It was clandestine. He was a room, I mean, he was like the dorm monitor person, employee, and I was a student, and so we couldn't have a relationship anyway, so, you know, it was doomed from the start. I didn't figure that out till about 10 years ago, but I could not quit calling him. I could not stop. I remember praying, please, God, let me quit calling this person. He is bad news. I knew there were other women. I mean, he would call me and want to take me shopping for his girlfriend's mink coat or whatever he was getting for Christmas, and I would go, you know. It was insane, and I couldn't stop. And so I kind of pulled myself together after a lot of pain there, and went off to graduate school, and, you know, I'd have these kind of cycles of control release. My behavior would be real out of control, and then I would kind of get it together again and study hard and work hard. And so, of course, I went off to graduate school saying, okay, I'm not doing any of that stuff anymore, and that lasted till the first round of tests. And and then I had to blow off some steam, and so the cycle kind of started up again, and that's where I met my spouse. And I think I skipped a page. No, I didn't skip a page. I met my husband, and we had a clandestine relationship at first. I would have called it an affair, basically. You know, it was not up and up. And but, you know, we kept at it, and I was kind of good for him. I was kind of a stabilizing factor, and he was fine. And so, you know, we just kept on, and I knew there were other women. I even found him with other women sometimes, and I just kept on. I just kept coming back, let's face it. See, I've learned that somewhere else, coming back. It's just coming back. So there's a lot of pain, you know, from the very beginning, and I just, you know, I just didn't know any other way to do it. I thought that if I just hung in there long enough that he would see that I was different from those other girls, and that he would love me, and everything would be different. So on some level, I guess that was true, because we got married. We got married, and we took a little geographic cure and moved, and I thought I really had done it that time, because we moved away from all the girls, and we were in a situation where we were both working very hard, working a lot of hours, and you know, for a while it was pretty good, but my anger began to mount as he was not at home a lot, and we didn't have a lot of connection time. And, of course, I was like, he met me, I was like the party girl, you know. And as soon as I put the ring on my finger, I was like, I'm not going out anymore. So I can say that if anybody changed once the relationship started, it was probably me, because I didn't want to do those things anymore. I wanted to nest. I wanted to build a family. You know, I wanted our little home, everything to be perfect. And so I set out about doing that. And so I kind of lived in my little fantasy world. And I worked hard at thinking that if I could just be pretty enough or thin enough or smart enough or fun enough. Well, sometimes fun enough, not very often, but I knew he was going to laugh at that, that he would come home more and that we would have more relationship and everything would be okay. So we rocked on like that for a while, and he was actually going to have a year where he was going to have a lot more time that year, and he decided to do a fellowship away for like 6 months, and I'm like, what? But I dutifully got everything ready for him to go. I bought the stuff, the apartment, I moved him in, and I was furious. I was livid that he was basically leaving me for this other thing. But I dutifully did my thing, and then had a little calamity, and he wound up going to alcohol treatment for 3 months. And it was a high bottom for me, because everybody thought he was away anyway, so nobody knew where he was. I had a good cover story, let's put it that way. And I went to the treatment center, and I learned a few things. I missed a few big things. One of them was that I was part of the problem. I missed that. I was terrified of anybody finding out. I mean, I was just terrified. And I had to protect all of my sexual secrets because, for me, the alcoholism was like, we're not doing this. You know, I had very low tolerance for that because I didn't grow up with it. But the sexaholism, I had very high tolerance for because, and I missed that. I knew I missed something in my story. My mother always had a relationship outside of my father. And, you know, I don't even know if any of those relationships were sexual, but I know they were emotional. And I saw them, I lived them. I thought they were normal until I was in my 30s. And it occurred to me one day, I wonder what my dad thought about this guy she was crazy about. And one of them was our minister, and when I was 16, I came home from school early one day, and they were in our house alone. Now, my mother had some very rigid rules, and that one was a huge no-no. And so, you know, I knew, you know, something was dreadfully wrong, and so I had grown up with that, so I became oblivious to it. I was really oblivious. So anyway, I protected the sexual secrets while he was in treatment, and did not tell the truth. didn't want anybody to know I'd been sexually abused. I hit that one really, really well. So he came home. We did some therapy. I went to Al-Anon for about a year and a half. I did make a couple friends in that program, and they were useful. And one thing I vowed with my girlfriend, whose husband was off at treatment with him, was that if this ever happens again, we're going to camp. They're staying home. So we get to that. We called it camp because we thought they were having such a great time while we were back home. So there's more to that story as we go farther. So anyway, he came home. It was good for a little while. It fell apart again. We separated. He actually left, and I was devastated again. But we had a move planned. We had jobs in another city. It was complicated, and we took another geographic cure. And once again, I thought we had kind of left that chapter behind, and I did not go to meetings when we moved, and I did keep up a little bit with my therapist and with my friends in the program there, and that might have been my lifeline when it all fell apart again. We had our daughter after several years of infertility, which was a stressor, of course, in our marriage. And something happened after she was born, and I think some of it was postpartum depression, but I think some of it was that I needed him. I really, really needed him. I felt very inadequate as a mother. I didn't really know what to do with the baby all day long, and very stressed, and I was angry. Oh, my goodness. I'm sure I was angry before, but I mean, I can remember just looking at him when she was about 8 weeks old and thinking, I hate you. And he would say these really nice things and be really helpful with the baby, and I would just think, I hate you. You know, I was furious. I don't really have a lot of reason why it suddenly came up for me, but I was furious with him. And we rocked along for a little while. We bought a new house, and it was like our dream house, and we moved in. And that year, that was 1999, I couldn't do it anymore. Our dog died. You know, we'd had this dog since we got married, basically. That's what started it. The dog died. I started crying. And my grandmother, my aunt, and my uncle all died within a short period of time. And my girlfriend back in South Carolina had a baby prematurely that did very poorly and was not expected to live. And this all happened within a few months. My dad had a major heart attack. It was just a lot of pain. And I didn't know what to do with it. I got down in my back. I've always been a very healthy person. I had this horrible lumbar spasm. 6 months of fighting this thing and could not get it well. I was just miserable about half the time. And somewhere in October of that year, there was craziness going on anyway, but it really got crazy between October and December. I
I sensed in my gut there was relapse going on. I wouldn't confront it. We had a lot of fights. And then all the while I'm making everything look perfect, you know. So I orchestrated the perfect Christmas of 1999 where everybody was absolutely miserable. And had all the families there. Everybody was dressed just right. The food was just right. Everything was just right in our new house. And everybody was miserable. And about 2 weeks before that Christmas, we had put our daughter in this thing at our church on Sunday nights. And she really enjoyed it. And so they you couldn't just drop them off. You had to go, sit in this small group with people, which I didn't want to do because I liked my isolation. But we didn't have a choice because she really liked it. So we let her go. So we went in this small group thing. And there's this book that we were reading. And it was about surrender. And this was a new concept in my spiritual life. My whole spiritual life had been about commitment and what could I do and how could I do it harder and work harder and make it work. And I realized in that December when I was so depressed and so hopeless and I couldn't understand it because we're living in this great house, I had this great kid and this great husband, and we looked like Barbie and Ken on the outside, and I was absolutely miserable. And I prayed that day. I said, God, I am scared of you. I'm scared of surrendering to you because I don't want to lose my stuff, like my stuff. And I don't know what that looks like. You know, I just don't know what it looks like. So I need help because I'm scared. And three weeks later, Y2K did not happen on January 1st, 2000. At my house, it happened on January 8th, 2000. And Y2K occurred, and I found out about relapse, and my husband was whisked away to treatment again. And interestingly, we worked in a facility that about 800 people worked there, and we both worked there. And one person in the entire 6 months that he was gone mentioned to me, "Well, how's he doing? Where'd he go?" No one ever asked. It was just like, poof. Like he disappeared. It was amazing. That was the isolation that I lived in. And what I thought was the biggest calamity of my life really turned into the biggest net of my life. I landed. The treatment center was great. They offered me a lot of things. They offered me a mentor who basically said, "Get to a meeting every day. Get a sponsor. Don't come back without one." And I was so broken. I was following directions at this point. And I got the disclosure about 3 or 4 weeks into the treatment process, and I was devastated. I was oblivious, and then I wasn't. You know, I really had no conscious knowledge of the acting out. But when I got to thinking about it, I was like, what was I thinking? You know, I on some level, I did know. And I had just learned to deny it because that's what I did when I was a kid. So what happened? That's what happened. And I white-knuckled it for the first 2 months, I would say, because I was trying to work and drive back and forth to this treatment and drive back and forth to meetings. I came to Essanon. I just felt so at home in my first Essanon meeting, and I heard the words spoken, and I was so relieved to hear about sexaholism, because finally I had a name for what had happened in my house. I mean, I never had a name for that all those years. You know, what was it? I didn't have a name. So now I had a name. And I had a place where I belonged, and for me, there was some relief in that. But I still white-knuckled the feelings. There's so much pain. I mean, I would grip the steering wheel and the therapist chair so hard sometimes. I thought I was getting arthritis in my hands. I went to a doctor and said, "I think I'm getting arthritis in my hands." And then I realized I would only have it on the days where I'd been there. And is this because I was gripping the chair so hard to try to keep from letting the feelings out? And one day I started to cry, and 4 years later I stopped. And it was just strange the day I started to cry. I remember it. It was like I didn't really understand why I was crying about this thing, but it was just something I could let out, and I started letting the grief out, and I started seeing a little bit of myself, and I got real crazy. I was food restricting a lot because somewhere in my craziness I thought, I can't feel my pain, so I'm going to show everybody else my pain by starving myself to death, and that wasn't real functional. I'm not a very good bulimic, but I did try it. It wasn't very fun. I didn't like it. Didn't work for me. But that was the kind of craziness. I mean, that was what I was doing with the pain. I just didn't know what to do with it. So I decided that I would go to treatment, too. And so I asked if I could come to treatment. And part of the reason I decided that was because we had this beautiful daughter, and I realized that somebody was going to have to get well for her to have a chance. And I didn't know if it was going to be him. And I thought, it better be me. So I remember praying that night in bed with her, and I thought, this is really funny. Oh, God, who's going to take care of my baby while I'm gone? And it was almost as if God laughed at me. Like, who's taking care of her now? It wasn't me. So so I went, and it was great to have that protected time to work on myself. And, you know, I guess it's kind of like working out. You can work out for a week or for an hour, once a week, for 25 years, and you might get there eventually. But for me, it helped to have that intensive time where I wasn't running back and forth to my life, you know. For me, feelings are hard to get to. You know, sometimes it takes 3 or 4 hours for me to feel anything. And so I was working on that feelings muscle, I would say, in treatment. And that was great until I came home. And then I came home, and within about 4 days, I was exactly back to where I started from. And I didn't have a regular meeting in Chattanooga, and there was no Essanon in Chattanooga, and that's where I was going to be for another 2 or 3 months. And so I scoured the meeting list one more time in Chattanooga. If you've ever seen it, it's handwritten, like it's just like all over the page. And so I found this open AA meeting. It was on my lunch hour, and I thought, I think I can do that. I didn't know where it was. Not the best section of town, but anyway, I went. And I walked into this huge room, at least 40% women, and it met every day and at noon. And that was really the beginning of my recovery, that group. And they accepted me for who I was and what I was there for. And I'm very, very grateful to this group. And I learned, you know, to be comfortable with men around, too. And they were very respectful. And, you know, the beauty of it was I started listening to other people. And I started seeing how judgmental I was. And I started to see, I saw people change. And it was amazing. And I was accepted. And so that was the beginning of my recovery. And then my spouse and I moved back in together after about a 10-month separation. We moved back here in Nashville because we didn't think we would make it in a town with no SA and S&on. And I actually quit my job and went about the business of recovery full swing. I went to meetings almost every day during that time, or at least every day during the week if my daughter was in school. And I went to all different kinds of meetings because there wasn't S&on every time. I went to OA, I went to Open AA, I went to Women's AA, I went to Al-Anon. And I'm grateful for that time. It was a very painful time for me. I had no emotional sobriety. Thank you, God, for the sponsors that I had because every day I was calling them with new crisis. And the meeting saved me, you know. I had such a hard time getting out of myself and out of my own pain, and meetings always brought me back to reality, to gratitude. So these are kind of, I just want to talk a few little things. How much time do I have?
If I still have time? I don't know.
I would say those next 4 years were, I would call it adrift on a sea of pain. And if any of you are adrift on that sea of pain, you know, I can relate to that. I've almost kind of forgotten, and I'm kind of glad that I still am with newcomers enough that I remember what it was like. And I was furious with my spouse. I was completely ashamed about still being married, and I couldn't leave. It's a terrible place to be in. I wanted to punish him about half the time. I wanted him to love me the other half of the time. You know, it was craziness. And so the emotional roller coaster, and I've had these horrible shame spirals. I mean, where, you know, I was just the worst of the worst of the worst. And finally, after 3 or 4 years, I finally got through my fifth step. My sponsor kept me on my fifth step for so long. I thought I was never going to get off the fifth step. But and it was good for me because I still was just, I just wallowed in shame, you know. And I would self, I mean, I didn't need anybody to shame myself. I carried the mess, and I carried it around in my head, you know. It's like, you're not doing it right. You're not doing it right. You know, that negative self-talk, I really had to address that and work with that. And so some of the things that worked for me, especially around my anger and later on my character defects, was the resentment prayer, and particularly around my husband. And I have to periodically revisit that. And that is to pray for him or them or whoever it is that I'm resenting, all the things that I want for myself for about 14 days. And usually it doesn't take 14 days for me. And I don't know what it is about the magic of praying for them what I want for myself, but it is like magic for me. And the resentment usually melts very, very quickly. I discovered my character defects with my sponsor in step 6 and 7. Perfectionism, one of the worst, and also one of the best, because all of my character defects are actually assets. Just depends on which side I'm using. A lot of arrogance and a lot of shame. And hopelessness, that's the one that really kind of baffled me. It's like, where did I get this? I can remember feeling rather hopeless, you know, about the age of 3 or 4, and I had kind of lived that way most of my life, that life was hopeless. And so I've been able to frame, you know, and people had called it depression, and I don't know. But when I frame my hopelessness as a character defect and I surrender it to my higher power, I find relief. You know, I find things to find hope about. And so, you know, having a frame of reference for that has been helpful for me. It's not someplace I have to stay. I've stayed there for many, many, many years. And just wanted to say a little bit about recovery in our relationship. First of all, I put my personal recovery first. I had to address my abandonment issues with my parents. I had to address my sexual abuse hard. I had to work at self-care, and I did that through my sponsor and meetings, and also reconnected with music. I always loved to sing and do some drama and music, and I got the chance to do that, and I've been doing it ever since. And, you know, that creative side of me, it gives me joy. There's nothing that can take that joy away from me. And I've always been, I'm a sleeper. I love to sleep. But, you know, I've learned to rest when I'm tired. And I'm still working on having fun, but that one's a tough one for me. Because fun for me is kind of like, you know, rearranging the closets and looking at it, you know. Some of you know what I mean. So I'm still working on the fun thing. I got a ways to go on that one. And then keeping the focus on myself. That was tough. I wish I had all the money back I spent talking about my spouse in therapy. Can I get that money back? But, you know, I needed to vent it a lot of times. I needed to get it off my chest, so I guess it was well worth it. And a lot of times I'd say, okay, enough. Now I'm going to talk about me. I can remember saying that. Okay, I'm talking about him. I stopped judging my spouse's recovery. He doesn't do it like I do it. He really doesn't do anything like I do it. But but he does it, you know. He does it differently, and he does it beautifully sometimes. But it's very different from the way I do it, and it's okay. And I try to do that with other people too. I try not to judge anymore because, you know, I'm very rigid. You have to do it this way. You have to do it this way. You have to do it this way. So I'm learning to let go of that. And then I had to take ownership of my part too. And the other part about relationship recovery is separation. We had a 10-month separation, a 22-month initial abstinence, several other in-house separations after that, another 6-month separation that was kind of divinely orchestrated. But the separation for me was almost completely necessary because I really could not focus on him. I felt what he felt. I read his mind. I thought ahead for him. I mean, it's like I couldn't stop doing it. It was amazing. So I really needed him out of my visual field to be able to get the focus on myself. And I began to take ownership of my part. Now, this was hard. It was really hard. I remember sitting in my first couple of S9 meetings and thinking, what have I ever done to make amends for? I was jumping way ahead, obviously. But my part is that I was no more capable in our marriage of an intimate relationship than he was. And I know that now. And some days, I'm still not. I had to take ownership that my spouse was as deeply hurt by my behavior as I was by his. And my part was my constant anger and disapproval. I can radiate shame. It's like I absorbed all that shame from all those teachers and my mother and all those things, and I could send it back out. Shaming words, shaming looks, shaming actions. My inability to give and receive touch. A lot of my abuse was touch, and I hated touch. Totally refused to accept that I needed it. Kind of divorced myself from touch, from gentleness, from nurturing, and my recovery has brought me back to those pieces of me that I had disowned. My holier-than-thou self-righteousness, which I still do every once in a while, quite often actually. And then the biggest thing, and it's really hard to be in a relationship with somebody who does this, and I do it all the time, is my inability to identify clearly what I want and need. You know, what a concept. I had always been so focused on the wants and needs of others that I would shoot mine out in these very nebulous, read my mind sort of ways, and ready to throw in the towel. And we'd go to a meeting, maybe together, maybe separately, and it was like magic. You know, we could come home and be civil to each other again. And then working with others, and I would hear other people tell me stuff on the phone, and I would give them wonderful advice and try to take it myself, usually, when I would give it to them, and gratitude. Not looking at my spouse, at only at his defects of character, which I had focused on for so long. And then the higher power of my understanding. You know, there were so many miracles in my recovery, I can't even begin to tell you about all of them. But one of my favorite things around the rooms that I hear is don't quit before the miracle happens. And miracles really did happen for me. A lot of the past 8 years, I spent in what I call recovery no man's land, where you feel like nothing is happening and you're just kind of stuck. And I hated those months, felt like years sometimes, where I was going nowhere and felt like I was doing the right things and I was going to meetings and working with others and, you know, nothing was happening. And I'll just talk real briefly about relapse. We've lived through two relapses. I've lived through two relapses. And I do know that my higher power has shown me what I needed to know when I needed to know it, and I don't really have to look for it. And I have learned to trust my instincts. And I am usually right if I stay close to my program and my intuition, then I know, you know. You know, I always want to know. You know, I want to know what's going to happen, but I don't have to be afraid anymore of not knowing because I know on some level. As long as I am in touch with myself, I know. I'll tell you one quick miracle. I'd had it. This was after the first relapse, and I was miserable. He was miserable, but I refused to look at any other options, or I had for a long time. And finally, I decided I wasn't very willing, and I'd been on my knees in the closet many nights. And so I went to see an attorney about some financial matters, and they said, you know, you ought to go see a divorce attorney. And there's one upstairs. Here's a card. And so I went upstairs to make this appointment. And the secretary said to me, you know, we're really busy. I can't really make you an appointment right now. Could you call back? Here's a card. And she gave me a card, and I thought, well, that's weird. So I went home, and there was an envelope in the mail, and my husband had gotten called to active duty for 6 months. And talk about divine intervention. So we got our little separation that I couldn't do for 6 months, and I didn't go see the attorney, and things really changed for me during that time. I needed that time away from the problem, which was mostly me, but my focusing on him was part of the problem. And I began to change, and I had renewed hope. And yes, there was another relapse. And I'll just real quickly, let's just say that 05 was a very bad year. My mother, and you know, right after I was working on amends toward her, she developed terminal cancer. And I had worked very hard on my issues with my mother, and she developed terminal cancer, and my spouse relapsed in the summer of that year, and it was very painful. And the day that we were going to tell my daughter that we were separating and he was moving out, I got a call early in the morning that my mother was headed to the hospital, and it was basically the beginning of the end for her. And I called it off because I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do both. I said, you know, God, I don't think you want me to do both these things at the same time. And we just stayed in in-house separation. And my worst fears, my enmeshed mother, the two people I didn't think I could live without, my mother and my husband, it was coming true for me all at one time. And she died in November. And that year, I called people every day, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I felt so held by my higher power and by the people in this program and my friends and even some by my family. And I was able to grieve with my mother and cry with her before she died and tell her goodbye. And it was next to the birth of my daughter, probably the most spiritual experience of my life. And I was able to be emotionally present. And I am eternally grateful for that experience. And even though it was painful, it just showed me, you know, I can get through it. And the best thing about that year, my life had been so lonely, even the first couple years of recovery. I'm so lonely. And I just wore my sponsor out. I'm so lonely. I was not lonely that year at all. I was never lonely. So I'm just really grateful for that today. And then my mother's last words were kind of a key for me. She was kind of in and out of consciousness, and she called for my father. We were at home, and she called for my dad, and he went to her, and he said, "What do you need?" And she just shook her head, and he said, he went through everything. "Do you need water? Do you need this? Do you need that?" And she shook her head, no. And he finally said, "Do you want me to just go away and leave you alone?" And she said, and my heart broke. Because it's me. I can't tell you what I need because I'm not sure. And so just go away and leave me alone. That was me. And so I decided I didn't want to live that way anymore. And I wanted to lay down the past and move on and learn how to tell people what I needed, because it wasn't that my father wasn't the love of my mother's life. It was that she just couldn't tell him what she needed, and she didn't know how to say, you know, just hold me or just be with me, just sit with me. And I didn't want to be like that. So today, my work is I stopped the anger circuitry. I have this anger circuitry that I've worked on for years, and it builds steam if I don't watch it, and I try to stop it early when I start feeling it mount, and I don't have to case build against my husband and drag thousands of things from the past. I'm not every day, but I want to be 100% in the marriage every day. I can't be. For so many years there in recovery, I was like, I'm going to be 50% in if I know you're in recovery. It doesn't work very well that way. It doesn't work very well. And then reestablishing trust. A lot of that's trust for myself and setting boundaries. I was so clear by the time the last relapse occurred, it was so crystal clear to me what the boundaries needed to be. The first year, I was like, boundary? What's that? I mean, I was clueless. I didn't know how to do it. So anyway, our marriage is not perfect, but it's a lot more comfortable, I would say. It's a lot less volatile, although we can certainly fight. We're both very headstrong people, but it's a lot more comfortable today, and there's a lot more honesty today. And this is my final words. I'll be quiet. I hung pictures of us when we were about 3 or 4 on the wall in the main room in our house, mostly because my husband's always complaining that we only have pictures of our daughter on the wall. But the other reason is that when I am having one of my schoolgirl fits, which occasionally I have, or he's having one of his schoolboy fits, I can look at that picture of that little boy or that little girl and remember that's the person I'm talking to right then. And I can just listen. That's kind of been the difference in recovery. Usually I would try to engage in a very negative way, but I'm learning to just listen through those times and let the person have their feelings, work it out. And he lets me have my feelings and I work it out. And I think that's all I have to say. Thanks.
Arrogant, grandiose individual. Also, the good thing about what just happened, I think, is that most of the time in our relationship, I spend most of the time in the limelight, and Donna's been sort of like, maybe in many ways, like Oz behind the curtain, moving things and making our coupleship look good, and so this was perfectly fitting. Believe me, I know you've been sitting for a while. I'll just spend a couple of minutes and sort of tell you a little bit about me and how I come to be in recovery, grateful recovery, and in this room tonight. I have to speak because my grand sponsor and sponsor both have mandated that that this is the absolute thing I must do tonight. About six months ago, when Donna asked me to participate, I think I was watching one of the ball games at the same time and kind of doing some reading, and I don't remember exactly, but I think I grumbled, "Nope, sure, fine." And a few months later, as it began to draw close to this date, I began to see this as a reality and started looking for ways out. Started speaking to, like I said, my sponsor and grand sponsor, and that wasn't considered an option. And that's one thing I've learned, is that to take advice or take direction, I shouldn't say, listen to experience from those who've gone before. And the other thing I was told is that about tonight is that whatever I do, I'm not supposed to make any notes. And if you knew me, you knew that I've lost more sleep over not making any notes than I have if I were making notes for a couple of things I wanted to say. So I'll try to say, well, I just didn't do that exactly. I had to write down a couple of things, so I'll probably have to have retribution for that at some point. But well, I'm sure there's a service thing or two I'll be doing as a result of that, but it'll be okay. I truly am grateful to be here. In some of the other things we call religions, resurrection is celebrated. And I get to live that. This is a new life I'm leading. And recovery sometimes, to me, seems to be just a little limited in the way what that word means. Because I don't really want to recover the life I've led most of my life. I'm living a different life. And so it's a new life in a way. And right now it seems a little bit like teenage years. I'm struggling quite a bit. but it's all about growth. And so I'll just launch into this, and if you'll bear with me. I know we have another meeting at 9 o'clock, and I'm not going to keep you here all that time. I, too, grew up in a very shame-oriented environment. Some of the first things I remember are learning, being aware of the fact that regardless of how I behaved, what choices I made, I inherited a sin that damned me for hell. And I know many of us in this room share that, and it's been a lot made of it, but just the hopelessness of that statement was overwhelming to me. And I remember having trouble sleeping at night. And I bet there are many men in this room, and women too, because I've heard you at meetings talk about the ways you began to self-soothe, and I certainly did that. I couldn't sleep at night for fear that I would die and I'd be separated from my family, all the good folks, what I thought were good folks, and I would be tormented. I developed this ritual, and by the way, I sort of talked to my wife about a couple of things I should and shouldn't say. Now, I've never really been to an Essanon meeting, and I've also learned that I think I need to be going to some more. But I began to self-soothe, and it wasn't long before that became a ritual that had a significant impact upon my life. I was a little, though, retarded. I'll use that term as far as sexuality is concerned. We didn't discuss that in my household, and for the longest time, I thought it was a miracle that each of the four children were exactly 4 years apart. I didn't realize that my parents were using birth control, a variety of techniques at that time, because I didn't know Baptist folks knew that. We thought it was just creationism happening all the time, exactly 4 years apart. I don't want to minimize that or offend anyone, but I really did grow up with that fantastic belief. My first relationship, though, was with myself. And my younger brother actually had to teach me that, if that tells you anything. So he's 4 years younger, and he's the one who educates me about sexuality. And the next person that would do that would be an older girl. And it just sort of escalated after that. The next thing where I would learn about true sexuality was Penthouse Forum. And as you know, there are lots of things that, for those of you who've had the unfortunate experience of reading that, there are lots of things in there that are untrue. And there are also expectations that I could never live up to, but I thought I must. If a woman would ever love me, or if I could ever love myself, if I would ever be accepted to be okay. So I'm not going to bore you with all the sexologue or drunkologue, but I would just say that I had no idea what it was like to be intimate physically with another person. And as far as emotional intimacy, there was none of that in our household. It's no different than most of us, except to say that it was a perfectionistic household in East Tennessee, and quite a bit of punishment involved, and parents were always right. There was no questioning. There was no discussion. And so I learned that that's the way one interacts with authority figures, particularly a father. And so that set me up to go through the rest of my life looking for a father and looking for authority figures and giving those people power over me, and set up this perpetual cycle that I could never achieve enough to be okay. I'm not going to, again, go into that. But I would like to touch on a couple of things. At graduate school, I did meet Donna. And by this point, my life had deteriorated to the point where my first drink of alcohol was as a sophomore in high school, but I was drinking practically daily. Did that all through college and then graduate school. But it wasn't just that. I was also looking for any other sort of change in my feelings or change in behavior that would subsequently change my internal endorphin level. I began exercise to the point of doing triathlons, marathons, trying to study. I was having sexual acting out behavior all over the place. And I began to develop tolerance, and many of you in this room know exactly what that's like. Regardless of what it is, you can never get enough. It wasn't just the physical tolerance, it was the emotional tolerance and the self-loathing that was associated with that. I mean, the more I would do, the more I would hate myself, the more I'd need to do to change the way I felt. And then, so I get to graduate school and I meet Donna, and there's I'll just jump to the point, that same event where she mentioned catching me in the act with other women. I mean, my perspective on that, although it was unconscious, is that I had found the perfect woman, a person who did not require any emotional intimacy, did not require me to be present in the relationship and committed, and who would take care of me and still accept me regardless of what I did wrong or what I did in my disease that I couldn't help but do. So it was really, I mean, to me, even as I hear it again now, and that describes the perfect Essanon relationship, you know. And I was unconscious of it, and it seemed like a dream from that point on till we were married. I don't know how it really happened. It was the most amazing thing. The next thing I remember, it seems like, from the realization that this woman is still going to want to be with me and accept me till I am about, you know, with my knees at the altar, and I'm thinking, what the heck is this? This is the honest truth. I had the first conscious thought thinking, my life is about to change. I began to cry, and that's the fear I felt there was because I knew already that I would not be able on some level to maintain my own set of values, what I felt like should be an institution that should be honored. Regardless of my attempts to control, there were periods of time when I would try to stop drinking. There were periods of time when I would try to stop acting out. It never lasted. And By the time I ended up in treatment in 1991, I did think I'd gone to camp. It was a place where I didn't have any responsibility. I could go to meetings. I could read. I could exercise. I could eat well. I could go to meetings at night. I could hang out with guys around the TV. I mean, and incidentally, there was an occasional thing I had to write, like steps, you know. So they sent me through the first, first five steps. You had to do a tiny little five-step activity in about 12 weeks. And I thought I was done. And I got back home, and I really didn't go to meetings. But I didn't drink any more alcohol for the next 7 years. But I was acting out sexually all over the place, and I don't want to be disrespectful here at this point, but it was really, really frightening. I'm really lucky the way things have worked out to be as healthy as I am at this point. And over time, I was able to externally look like I was doing okay. In fact, by the time we had moved to Chattanooga, as Donna mentioned, people were telling me, even though I'd openly said I'm a recovering alcoholic, you do not look like an alcoholic. You are not disheveled. You seem to have a nice car. You're not living underneath the bridge. But what they didn't know was inside I was so empty. That I was continuing my sexual acting out, that I was hiding it from my wife, that my partners were becoming increasingly needy, it felt like to me. But the truth of the matter is that I had a stash. I used them just like I would any alcoholic would for stashing alcohol in a variety of different places. And whenever I would have a feeling, I didn't know that's what I was having, but whenever I was having one of those, I would need to treat it and medicate it. 2 minutes, thank you. Okay, I appreciate that. In 2000, I came to Nashville. I was at an AA meeting. I'd had another DUI. I went to that meeting and I started noticing the relationships that were occurring between men and women. As a matter of fact, I began to get a buzz myself from talking to the other people who were wounded in that meeting. I said to my counselor, I said, I think something's not right here. I think I have a problem where I need a relationship. I went to my first SA meeting. Some of you who were at that meeting are sitting right here in this room. At that time, we had to qualify in the Nashville meetings. The first person who went through the list of acting out behaviors, I could feel a relief. I knew I was home. And then after that, people laughed. People started hanging out. But the weight of that shame that I was carrying around, the ability to convey it to someone else who could listen to you say those things about yourself, who could say it about themselves and not reject me, I knew I was home. So we moved here. Anyway, I'll stop there. The strength. Anyway, that's my experience in a nutshell. The strength is this. I've learned about humility. I've learned that I've got to have a higher power. It's been up to me up to this point until I get to Nashville and learn about SA, where I learn about a higher power who can actually take control of my life, because I'm powerless and what I've been doing is mismanaging my life. I learned to be honest. Or try to be honest. It takes a long time. I built up such fortifications necessary for survival in my world to the point where I needed to become increasingly honest. I had to become willing, we talk about in these programs, willing to listen to what someone tells me, willing to try something different, willing to take a different kind of step. And then the service deal. This has been the hardest thing for me, I must admit, to actually act in a certain way to try to do something for someone else without some benefit for me. This program, though, provided a way to do it. I get to stay sober by trying to do something for someone else. I mean, it is kind of a backward way to get me to do service, but I do know now that that's where the strength to take the next step comes from. And this transparency, learning to continue to try to be open to have no secrets is the thing that helps keep me sober. Last thing I promised I would say to my sponsor just a minute ago is talk about hope. Because he said there'd be people in this room who's in both programs who don't understand that there is a different way, who just are here hoping that there's something that can be different, that there can be a chance to have a different life. He talks about true ambition, to live my life usefully, to walk humbly under a higher power. It says this in the big book. To look to serve family, friends, business, and community without self-gain. I learned to be a partner with others, to work with you all to try to help save each of our lives. I didn't even have a chance to go into this, but I learned that money was not my security, but money could be a servant. It could be a way. It doesn't have to be my master. It can be a way I can be of service. I don't have to dominate you or let you dominate me to be okay. I can feel safe if we're just partners. I learned that my drives, all of these drives, can be good. They're God-given if used appropriately, if they're in the right size. They're restored by this program and by working the steps to their true size and true purpose. And then I learned that... can I take 1 second? I'll just say, last night I watched that football game, and did you, you know, I don't know if anybody's interested in that, but that guy Tebow is a hero in a way. I know he's been overbuilt. No one can live up to those expectations, but those two interceptions in the first half I thought were devastating. But the way that guy handled it and said, you know, I've made some mistakes. I'm going to lead by action. I'm going to lead this team. I'm going to get my act together, and we're going to do the next right thing. Now, for you that are Oklahoma fans, I'm sure that's not very useful. but that's it. I had relapses. I've had bad days. You know, it's a day at a time. Sometimes for me, it's a minute at a time. But, you know, the fact that I'm willing to get going again and keep doing the right thing. And the last thing I've always wanted is the ability to have peace. I just want to mention that. I've always felt like there's something wrong with me. On the inside, I've always felt like there's not enough, and I just couldn't be happy. I needed to be doing something. But, you know, I have periods of peace today, and it's promised to me that I can have peace, joy, and happiness if I continue to work this program. And I do believe that that's the case. And it's all about surrender. I won't go into that, but I have to surrender my selfishness and self-centeredness. I have to be willing to try something different and to turn my life over to a higher power. And right now, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to be here. And thank you for helping support each of us as we walk this path.